This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Raising children gets expensive from the moment they're born, but one expense is getting some more attention from the White House. The president's daughter and advisor, Ivanka Trump, is leading the push for more spending on child care, a campaign that's reflected in the president's new budget, which was released this week. The new budget proposal includes billions for various programs to help needy parents get child care so they can remain in or return to the workforce. Now, budgets are up to Congress. The White House proposal is just a request. But it does touch on something that many families do struggle with. Perhaps child care is an issue for you, and we'd love to hear your stories and questions about child care and how you handle the costs. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us in studio is Elaine Weiss, the former national coordinator for the Broader, Bolder Approach to Education campaign at the Economic Policy Institute. Elaine, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much, Joshua. It's great to be here.
Also here in studio is Gina Adams, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. She directs the Low-Income Working Families Project and the Kids in Context Initiative. Gina, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we should note both the Economic Policy Institute and the Urban Institute are left-of-center policy think tanks based here in Washington. But we welcome your questions and comments across the political spectrum, 1A@WAMU.org. Gina Adams, let me start with you. Child care means lots of things to lots of people. So maybe for the sake of putting this conversation into some context, into some boundaries, what do we mean for the purposes of this when we say childcare?
So I think there's two ways of thinking about childcare. One is simply when you have somebody else taking care of your child, and that can range from your mom, the neighbor, a child, family childcare home, which is usually in somebody's home, not a relative, or a childcare center. So that's one way you think about it. It's kind of non-parental care is the jargon we use. But the other way of thinking about it is care that you pay for. And that's the kind of issues that we're talking about, I think, today, which is the issues around expense.
Elaine, give us a snapshot of the problem in terms of lack of access to affordable child care. How bad is it right now?
So I know that right now a lot of us are pretty hesitant to use terms like national emergency or crisis for good reason. Unfortunately, that is an appropriate way to describe the situation that we're in. We really have a crisis with respect to child care on multiple fronts. For young children, it's a crisis because many millions of them don't have quality, stable care and thus are not going to be prepared for school or for life. For parents who lack access to reliable, good care, it's hard to imagine anything more stressful, but it also means that they can't work productively without worrying. And for child care providers, it's a crisis because many of them are living in or near poverty while also doing jobs that we deem very important. And then to compound all of that, we have a drag on our economy because we have not only workers who aren't as productive as we'd like them to be, but we have women who literally cannot enter the workforce and drag down our GDP as a result.
We want to touch on various aspects of what you just described as the conversation goes on. We also want to share a lot of your stories as well. And man, did we hear from quite a few of you who are struggling with childcare. Here's just one of the voicemails that landed in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Arthur from Denver, Colorado. I want to talk about the effects that child care and its costs had on my opportunity to be a single father with a decent job. Out here, they don't have child care that offers times for anyone that may need to work late, early, or even overnight. They only have child care out here that is during normal business hours, which turned out to be a problem for me at one point.
Yeah, Arthur, thanks very much for calling in and sharing your story with us. Gina, how common is Arthur's problem in terms of access to child care for parents who work outside of the regular 9-to-5?
It's actually extremely common, and one of the challenges really that we're facing is this is a growing issue as jobs become more precarious, people have less ability to control their time. We found a recent study that working outside of traditional daytime hours is about 3 out of 5 low-income children with working parents live in a household where all of their caretakers work outside of at least some hours outside of the 8-to-6. So that's 3 out of 5 kids have parents have situations similar to what we're talking about.
We also heard from Melanie in Birmingham, Alabama, that left us another voicemail which echoed many of the ones we received. Here's what Melanie left in our inbox.
My husband and I would love to expand our family. Right now we have a 3-year-old daughter who is in full-time daycare, and both my husband and I work full-time. The cost of daycare is hindering us from wanting another child at this point. We are trying to strategically have another one so our oldest would actually be in kindergarten or in a pre-K program, which would be cheaper than full-time daycare. I would love to see an initiative to make things more affordable for families like myself who are working full-time and doing what we can.
Melanie, thanks for sharing your story with us. Also, Andrew tweeted, "My wife and I will have our first, a boy, in July. We had to sign him up for a spot in daycare last month. Last month, in utero. To me, that's absolutely nuts. This was in no way anything upscale either. What a strange and expensive system we have." Elaine Weiss, is this normal, this expense for childcare, which in D.C., according to your organization, is the highest? It's $18.86 a month. And also the kind of family planning that has to go around childcare. Is this normal?
Well, as we're hearing from all three of these folks, this unfortunately is increasingly the norm in this country. That, however, should not become a new normal. And that's what I mean when I say this is a crisis. We are an outlier country in a number of ways, and many of those ways are showing up in what these callers are saying. We are sending the economic message to families that basically whether or not they should have children depends on whether or not they can afford to pay to have those children. This is not something that happens in any other Western country or competitor countries. Those other countries all ensure paid parental leave, for one thing. When these families had kids, they would have paid time off to take care of their children, which needs to be a norm. We are a huge outlier in that. These are countries that provide subsidies to families that can't afford it for childcare. These are countries that provide pre-K as a matter of course. These are countries that include France, that from birth all the way through when a child goes to kindergarten, it is assumed that because raising children, healthy children, is a public good, the public helps to pay for this, and it's not a norm.
Gina?
If I could just add to that, Elaine and I were actually talking about this out in the hallway. This isn't a system. That's the part of the problem. I mean, this is a hodgepodge of situations where parents are pretty much on their own. Most parents simply have to go out into the market and find what they can find based on the income they have, which if they don't have much income is not a very good set of options. Or if they have particular circumstances, like we just heard about, working non-traditional hours or live in a rural area or have a baby, which is a young child, which is much more expensive. All of those kinds of constraints mean that you have extra hurdles as a parent as you walk out into that non-system. It's really just a market-based situation. Our public policies help certain parents in certain ways, but we by no means have a system.
We're speaking to Gina Adams, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, and Elaine Weiss of the Economic Policy Institute. We'd love to hear from you, too, whether you are a parent or perhaps you are a child care provider. We'd love to know what you're dealing with economically in terms of being able to keep providing child care, what that means for you. We know that child care providers don't get paid that much. So how are you holding up as a child care provider? Or maybe if you are a parent, what are you doing to try to help fill that gap? Or maybe if you're a policymaker and you're trying to find solutions so more people can have child care, what are you thinking through? What are some of the ideas that you're putting out there? 1A@WAMU.org. Glad to get some of your stories in terms of what you're dealing with. David emailed, "Our daughter was born late in 2005. In mid-2009, my wife wanted to go back to work. We looked into the costs of childcare and losing our food stamps against how much she would make at a slightly above minimum wage job with 30 hours a week. After adding the numbers up, we figured out we would make an extra $100 a month while not really raising our daughter and adding a whole lot of stress to the family. We decided to keep our sanity and let mom be a stay-at-home for another few years." Gina, there also, in addition to the issues with finding childcare, there have been stories of children being mistreated at some daycare centers across the nation. How much of that factors into the larger issue with childcare? Is it mostly just an issue of access, or is it also an issue of kids being treated well when they get that care?
I think one of the big changes that's happened in recent years is that parents are understanding the importance of good quality care, the brain development, all of that kind of research, and people really understand that the quality of the care that you put your child in makes a big difference. I don't think we really knew that 20, 30 years ago. So I think parents are understandably walking into these situations and looking for something that they think is good for their child. And unfortunately, the quality of care is very variable across this country. In some places, it's extremely good. In some places, it's not so good. We've making progress in trying to support that through creating basic regulations that create a floor of quality, but I think we have a long ways to go.
With regards to quality, and I know we got to pause in a minute, Lacey tweeted, I'm a preschool teacher by trade. If both of my children attended the school where I work, I would be paying to work. I probably would not even break even. Quality child care is just too expensive. Before we pause, Elaine, what do we mean by quality child care?
We mean a lot of things when it comes to quality. We know as parents that when we take care of our kids, there's quite a lot involved in taking care of our kids. It's really an investment. When we talk about childcare, we're talking about those same things for someone who we're paying to take care of our kids. We're talking about people who are schooled in child development. We're talking about, as Gina said, certainly basic safety, basic health measures. All of those things cost money. All those things require regulation and monitoring. And then beyond that, we're talking about adults who know how to nurture children, know how to stimulate children, and really how to educate children.
Speaking of that investment, there are some mixed opinions on who should pay that investment. Chris writes, if they can't afford children, they shouldn't have them, period. We'll talk about where the money comes from for child care when we continue our conversation with Gina Adams of the Urban Institute and Elaine Weiss of the Economic Policy Institute. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the state of child care in the U.S. with Elaine Weiss of the Economic Policy Institute and Gina Adams of the Urban Institute. We'd love to hear from you, too, how the cost of child care has affected you and what decisions you've had to make because of it. Also, if there's any kind of support that would be the most helpful to you, whether it's government support or some other kind of support, we'd love to know more about that as well. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Sarah writes, after our daughter was born, my husband quit his job in order to stay home full time. Had he continued working, all of his wages would have gone into paying for child care. Lee tweeted, I'm a public radio reporter in Illinois, and while childcare is a crisis among all families, it is especially dire for parents of special needs children. I've heard from many parents who've had special needs kids kicked out of childcare or can't afford it. Elaine, I'd love you to comment on Lee's tweet. First of all, I hope that whatever public radio outfit she's working for in Illinois is taking childcare for its employees into consideration. I say that as someone who has worked in public radio and knows how hard it is at times to live on the salary of a small town public radio reporter. So, Lee, I hope your station takes your comment very seriously, because I do. But Elaine, to her point about special needs kids and childcare, what about that?
So special needs kids and child care are just one example of why this is a classic market failure. We have, as Gina said, a non-system where, by definition, parents, especially parents of very young children, parents of special needs kids, parents whose kids are particularly expensive, unless they are unbelievably wealthy, will never be able to pay for the care that those kids need. And those are just kids who are there. At the same time, we have providers who cannot possibly survive and live on the kind of money that parents can pay. This is literally a definition of market failure. The same would be true if we didn't have a system of public education. The vast majority of parents could not pay privately for quality K through 12 education for their children, and yet we recognize that we need as a society to educate our children. And so we recognize a societal need. This is a market failure. It cannot possibly be paid for privately.
And I guess part of the challenge, Elaine, is that, you know, when we talk about special needs, that can mean a thousand different things.
Exactly.
That can mean kids who are developmentally disabled, kids who have more of a medical disability, a physical disability. So there's not like a one size fits all childcare for special needs. It could mean they have a learning disability. It could mean
yes.
anything.
And in fact, we do have federal policies designed to help and to subsidize, because we do recognize that there are a range of special needs and that parents cannot possibly pay for them. But like all of our early childhood programs, they are severely underfunded. And so we have a lot of parents like your caller saying, I'm not getting the help that I need.
Before we get into the White House's proposal, Gina, how much of this is a workforce challenge? I mean, are there enough people in the U.S. doing this kind of work? Set their salaries aside for a second. Are there enough people doing the work to accommodate all the children who need care?
By definition, yes, but not necessarily the way we would want it to work. For example, you don't want to have just anybody caring for kids. You want to have somebody with training, somebody who's knowledgeable, somebody who loves children. So what we have is we get what we pay for right now, which is we have a hugely variable workforce. If we paid more, we would be attracting more people. We would be able to support those people who are currently in the workforce and help them get better skills. But right now we have people because parents, you know, they're doing something with their children. It's just the question is, what are they doing and whether that's the workforce that we really want.
One more comment before we talk about the president's proposal. Simo Atheist tweeted, no child care daycare facilities in my rural county in Missouri. That holds families hostage in poverty. Harder to have a two-income household. Elaine, I saw you nodding in response to that.
This is actually another issue that Gina and I were talking about outside and very much hoping would come up. Rural issues in general get far too little play in policy and in discussions in this country, and rural poverty and issues, there really are very different issues in rural areas. There is, as the caller noted, it's isolated, it's hard to get to places. And as Gina's been talking about, our focus in the past few years on center-based care increasingly is particularly inappropriate in rural areas where there just aren't enough kids in a small area to get them to a center. So we do really need different strategies. There are strategies being incubated in rural areas, and that's another place where we could really use investment. I could talk about it more when we have more time.
Gina?
I just wanted to add something to that. We just recently did a paper looking at access issues in rural areas, among other things. And one of the things that really struck me, excuse me, is that you have to have different kinds of options because the market doesn't demand support centers, as she said. So you really have to be thinking about home-based options. There's been a massive decline in family child care, which is one of the major home-based approaches. There's been a decline all over the country that we're trying to understand what that's about. But we really have to focus on supporting other kinds of options for the range of families that can't use centers.
So these would be people who are equally qualified to care for children, but maybe they run child care just out of their home, just
right.
as part
exactly.
of like a neighborhood child
exactly.
care option.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the White House budget, the 2020 budget. It came out on Monday. It calls for increasing spending on child care, proposes some initiatives to address shortages. Part of the proposal was put forth, according to NPR's Tamara Keith, by senior White House advisor and first daughter Ivanka Trump. She proposes a one-time increase of $1 billion to the Child Care and Development Block Grant. That would be on top of the $5.3 billion that's included in the grant, so $6.3 billion total. That $1 billion that Ivanka Trump proposed would be used to help underserved populations get access to child care. Before we pick apart the idea, Elaine, first, can you just kind of define for us what the Child Care and Development Block Grant is? What does that do? Gina, can you define for us what is the Child Care and Development Block Grant?
The Child Care and Development Block Grant, we call CCDBG or CCDF, is the major national program that supports low-income families in paying for care. So it basically provides money to states, and states use that money to give to parents, usually for vouchers, to help them purchase care, usually on a sliding fee basis. So very poor families have to pay less, slightly better off. But it's radically underfunded. Only about 1 in 7 children currently who are eligible are able to get it. And many states are not able to pay the rates, for example, that would allow good quality providers to serve. So it's already a significantly underfunded program, even though it recently did get a big increase.
And states also have very long waiting lists. Some states have such long waiting lists that they've cut off their waiting lists.
How underfunded are we talking about, Gina?
1 in 7 eligible kids are served, and the quality of the care, even though this program has really been working on this, as I said, only one state, for example, pays at rates that are sufficient to purchase quality under the recommended federal standards. So even the kids that are getting it may not be getting the kind of care that we really want them.
Is that just because there's not enough money? Is that because not enough states are applying for it? Not enough families know about it? Like, where are the breakdowns?
All the money's being used. There's not enough money.
That's not that people aren't going for the money.
No, not that they're not going for the money.
Do we have clear benchmarks in terms of like what proper pay should be for childcare, or how much ought to be said? Like, is there a national standard for that?
There's recommendations that the federal government gives, and for example, in terms of how much states should pay, they should pay what the provider charges up to enough to cover about 75% of the market is what the feds recommend. But very few states are paying that high, which means that a lot of the providers that are the higher end providers who provide the highest quality care may not be able to afford to accept a voucher from the state.
Now, whenever it comes to providing money for public services, there are people who believe that it should be spent, people who believe it should not. We've heard from both in our conversation. One of our listeners named William left this in our inbox.
I don't understand why families are looking for others to come and help support them with child care and everything else. As I see it, when I was younger, my parents took care of us. I understand now, because of the cost of everything, that both parents have to decide if they're going to work or not. But if you're going to have a family and want to raise kids, you cannot keep on looking for others to help you. And when others do comment or try to help, people, I have found out, get mad and they don't want your assistance. They just want your money.
William, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Chris also left a note in our inbox. Chris writes, if they can't afford children, they shouldn't have them, period. Elaine, what would you say to William and Chris?
I would say two things to them. I'd say, first of all, I think we fundamentally misunderstand, in very traditional ways, how children have always been raised. And that is that it has always taken a village to raise a child. There is a reason that in traditional societies, extended families live together, that children are raised by multiple people. Never in the history, literally, of human society has it been the case that a child is just raised by two parents. This is a pretty recent and, frankly, fairly American unique way of thinking about raising children. It's actually not the way it happens. But I think there's another way to think about this. When people who say we don't have the money or we shouldn't put public money into this, we recognize as a country that there are things that we have to do to make our country work. When our roads aren't paved, we put money into paving them. When our railroads break down, we put money into repairing railroad tracks. We don't just sit back and say, sorry, we don't have the money for that. We're not going to do it. We recognize what the cost would be if we didn't. This is what we're doing right now with childcare. We are setting up millions of children in this country to crash and to be derailed. And we are ensuring that their path to having a thriving adulthood is almost off the charts.
Brian emailed, when I built my house for myself and my two chihuahuas, I had to pay $6,000 to the local school system. I have no issue paying for roads and things that I use, but I chose not to have children and don't want to pay for other people's kids. Gina, what about that?
Well, those children are going to be paying for Brian's Social Security. They are going to be paying for his Medicare. They are going to be paying for those roads, because they're going to be the future taxpayers. So actually, Brian does need to be supporting those kids, because those kids are going to be supporting him.
Presumably, at some point when Brian gets older, he might need a doctor. One of those kids is going to be his doctor. He might need a nurse. He might need a lot of things. I don't know where Brian thinks our future generations will come from, but whether or not he has children, someone presumably is going to have them.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. I got to say, I see both sides of this argument. I mean, in terms of those who say, if you can't afford a kid, don't have one. You know, I was not entirely a planned pregnancy. And my mom and dad married. I was born to a married couple, but they divorced when I was five. So what's went from being an affordable childcare situation with a father who was working a very lucrative job immediately changed to being the child of a single mother who worked three jobs to make a way for me. So before people judge the way children come into the world, just bear in mind, if I came in the ideal way and had to be held to that standard, I wouldn't be the host of this show today. So there's that. However, I also have an extended family, so my grandmother could help, and my uncle, my mother's brother, could help, and the church could help. Like, there were other institutions around us in our community that formed the village that raised me. That's how I'm able to be here. So, Gina, I kind of see both sides of this, that there's a school of thought that says that every child should be cared for, but it doesn't always have to come out of my pocket as a taxpayer, there should be other ways.
There should be other ways, but I think increasingly child care is becoming more like education. So if a family, I mean, I think many families would prefer to use relatives, caregivers, those kinds of things, and that's great if you have access to them. Many families don't have access to them, so that's not an option for them. This is an issue that's affecting families across the income spectrum. One of the big issues right now is that the limited public funds we have are available mostly to low-income families, and there are many middle-income families who are having the equal struggle. So it's such a pervasive problem, and people clearly are not having access to the people that they need to support their kids and help them raise their kids, that we really need to be thinking about how are we going to address that issue, given that our future productivity as a country is dependent on it. So it's a very tangled situation.
I wonder, Gina or Elaine, what your read is at the moment. I know it's super duper early, but what your read is on how Congress kind of views this child care proposal as it stands. Again, White House budgets are aspirational and everything could change between now and then, but is there any early read or is it just kind of too soon to know?
On Ivanka's proposal?
Yeah, on Ivanka's proposal.
My sense is that the biggest pro of her proposal, frankly, is the fact that she has made this such a front and center issue, along with, frankly, Elizabeth Warren, who's done the same thing, and along with the proposals that are out there in Congress. That said, it really, I have a hard time seeing this go very far for several reasons. The fundamental reason is, frankly, it's such a tiny amount of money, and it's a one-shot deal. And as we've been talking about, these are ongoing problems. When we're talking about consistent problems of underpaying, undertraining, undereducating, and undersupporting a workforce, a one-shot infusion of $1 billion doesn't do anything. We are talking about, as Gina said, the lack of a system. Building a system takes years. It takes serious investment. It takes investment over time. It takes consistency. Hers does none of those things. The other real problem with her proposal is that, and it's related, is that it asks states to compete in ways that we don't want states to compete. When we talk about a lack of childcare for children across this country, a lack of support for parents across this country, we don't want winner or loser states. We don't want states that can't do or won't do what they're asking to do and thus don't have childcare. And then finally, the one piece that she targets to states makes no sense. It doesn't actually aim at a problem in the system. The problem in the system isn't overregulation, it's underregulation.
Gina, what about Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal for universal child care? Can you tell us more about that proposal and what your sense is of it?
Yes. I mean, basically, Senator
Warren.
Her proposal is a universal proposal that covers a number of key components. I think when we look at any proposal at this point, what we're trying to look at, does it cover a range of child care costs for lower to middle income families, which hers goes up to, I believe, 200% of poverty? I'm trying to remember. I believe that's
right. I think it is 200%.
It doesn't, one of my concerns is it doesn't cover children up to age 13. I think school age child care is a big issue that we're not paying enough attention to as a country right now. Much of our focus has been on early learning, which is absolutely critically important, and I support that, but that's a gap. We do need to be thinking about supporting quality care in a sustained way that invests in providers over time and invests in helping them get there. We have a very diverse workforce right now, but many of them, as we've heard, work very low wages. So asking them suddenly to be getting higher degrees, et cetera, is very challenging unless we actually are willing to put resources in there to make sure that they have the supports to be able to go to school and get that extra training.
Elaine, before we pause, what do you make of Senator Warren's proposal?
Well, I would agree with Gina. I think, some have tried to tag it as radical. I think far from being radical, it's practical, it's eminently doable. There's no question it will take time to build up this workforce. I would, however, point naysayers to the fact that just a few years ago, Mayor Bill de Blasio came to power in New York City promising to put thousands, tens of thousands of children into high-quality full-day pre-K. There was a lot of skepticism that it could be built up in such a short amount of time. And in fact, in the short course of 2 years, he did put tens of thousands of children into high-quality full-day pre-K, did build up a really, really strong workforce, worked with diverse providers, and so far as pretty much anyone can tell, it's doing pretty well.
We should definitely talk about solutions when we continue our conversation. We'd love to hear more from you in terms of what would make it easier for you to get the child care you need, or if you're a child care provider, what would make it easier for you to stay in business. We'll talk solutions, 1A at WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page, and we'll get to your thoughts in a minute. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about vaccinations. Recent measles outbreaks around the country have reignited conversations about parents who choose not to vaccinate their children and the public health risks that choice can create. In response, some states are considering laws to make vaccination a requirement of attending public school. If you have wrestled with the decision to give your child vaccines, what made the decision tough? Where did you turn for information? And how did you resolve it? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Perhaps you're a healthcare provider who's dealt with parents who are struggling with this decision. How did you help them through that struggle? And did they heed your advice? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. You'll find 1A Vox Pop, VOXPOP, in the App Store, and we'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Gina Adams and Elaine Weiss. Still time to get in a few more of your questions and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. Let me get back to this question of affordability before we move on. I think the core concern from those folks who say things like, if you can't afford to have kids, then don't have kids, comes from the fact of the matter that our government right now is in a long-term structural deficit, that there are all kinds of social imperatives that we literally can't afford to pay for, and our kids are going to end up paying for it years from now. Can we as a nation afford to pay for this kind of childcare? Elaine?
I think that, I would not normally say this to you, but I think that is the wrong question. I think the question is, can we afford not to pay for this kind of child?
Well, don't answer a question with a question. Can we afford to pay for it or not?
We can definitely afford to pay for it. We have chosen not to pay for it. And the reality is that we don't know it, but we are paying for it now in terms of terrible outcomes because of not paying for it. So we pay through the nose. We pay for a lot of extra kids in special education who aren't ready. We pay for kids who are in remedial education. We pay for kids who don't graduate high school. We pay for kids who don't pay taxes. We pay for kids on public assistance. We pay for kids who go to jail. We pay for kids who are unhealthy. And we pay for a less productive workforce. The question is that how we want to pay for not paying for childcare? I don't think anybody thinks that's how we want to pay. If we paid for childcare that was quality instead of what we're doing now, we would avoid many of those outcomes.
So, Gina, basically we pay on the front end or we pay on the back end, and it's cheaper to pay on the front end?
Absolutely. And it's also morally right.
Let me get to another line of commenting in terms of how to pay for childcare. Terry is in northern Colorado. Terry left this in our inbox.
I have a new grandson, and for the first year of his life, I traveled 50 miles one way so I could watch him on Thursday and Friday. So I would travel down there on Thursday, spend the night, and then come back on Friday. And then my daughter had daycare for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It was just too expensive to have it all the time. So it not only affects the immediate family, but also the extended family.
Terry, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us, and congratulations on the new grandson. I bet he is the cutest thing ever. And I wonder about families that are finding their own solutions and might need help just being able to provide childcare within the family. Sandra emailed, why don't we create policies that support a stay-at-home parent, give tax breaks to people who choose to stay and raise their own kids, and provide other benefits to help these parents learn the best ways to raise their children and lead healthy lives? Elaine?
I think this speaks to what we were talking about before, which is that different solutions will work for different families in different contexts. And we absolutely need to create a system, period. But we definitely need to create a system that works for all families. One of those things is called paid family leave, parental leave, which again is what every other country but us has. And that would indeed help families like the one that just called in. As lovely as it is for grandma to drive, maybe grandma can't drive 50 miles both ways. Maybe that child is sick and you don't really want 82-year-old grandma exposed to a sick baby. There's all kinds of other reasons that this might not be the best arrangement, or you don't want it to be the only arrangement. There are certainly other ways that we as a country can support families where they are.
Gina, I wonder if also on the flip side, this affects the argument in terms of, well, there are families who can find their own solutions, so maybe the government solution in terms of child care needs to be more targeted, needs to be more varied, because not everybody's going to need the government to pay for one kind of child care for everyone.
Absolutely. And right now the system, I mean, most parents don't want to get government help. I mean, so they're not going to go for it. The thing is, if you put a system out there, it will appeal to the families who need that kind of support. And I think that's the appropriate place for that decision to be made. It sounds like Terry is a wonderful grandmother and her daughter wanted that. There are other folks for whom the grandmother may not be the right person to take care of their child, and forcing them to use the grandmother where it may be some abusive situation or drug situation or health situation is not appropriate. So parents are not going to be going for support unless they need support. They'll be choosing other options if they possibly can.
Let me get to a few more of your stories before we continue. Steve tweeted, "During the recession, I had lost my job and eventually had to give up looking because the low wages being offered would have all gone towards childcare for our 2-year-old. This lasted for 2 years. 10 years later, we have not fully recovered from that setback." TJ writes, "I am a single mother with a master's in social work. I have an 11-year-old who is transgender. My mother used to help me, but has been estranged since my child came out. I lost my last job due to violating attendance policy because I had to leave work twice after the school nurse called when my daughter was sick. The current child care that is available is expensive and not supportive of my child. I am now receiving food stamps, on Medicaid, and over $15,000 in debt. A first for me." Elaine, what would you say to TJ? What a heartbreaking and also somewhat unique kind of situation to be in.
Sort of a unique situation. Unfortunately, probably not as unique as it sounds here. Yes, his particular situation, his situation reflects two realities. One is that this increased cost of childcare is compounding a lot of other inequities that are causing major income and wealth divides. The fact that we aren't moving our minimum wage up, that we don't have a minimum wage that even gets folks up to or above poverty.
Oh, and I beg your pardon. I think you mean her situation. TJ wrote that TJ's a single mother.
Sorry.
That's
yes.
Right.
Is compounding this. So we have a lot of other policies in place that are compounding this problem. But what I wanted to say more broadly is this is not such a small problem. And this is why I don't think TJ should feel like her situation is unique. We're talking about child cares that can exceed rent in many places. We're talking about child care that in a majority of states now costs more than in-state college tuition. So we're not talking about a small minority of families that can't afford this. We're talking about now a growing majority.
Gina, is there a standard? Well, go ahead and make your comment, Gene, and then I got a question for you.
I was going to say two things quickly. One is I think one of the points that TJ's story points out to me is this affects the child. That 11-year-old is facing serious challenges because of not having access. It affects the parent. It affects the employers who don't have access to TJ's skills and affects our economy because we don't have access to her tax payments into the system and are paying public benefits. So this kind of shows why this is a communal problem. This is not just a family problem. The other thing it points out to me is it goes back to the issue of training for providers, because what you want is providers who understand how to deal with transgender kids, who understand how to deal with special needs, who understand how to deal with any particular unique issue that the family has. But with an underfunded system, you have any providers who may not understand those issues.
Gina, I was going to ask, is there a standard for how much, what percentage of your budget child care should ideally cost? I mean, I've heard that rent, if you're renting an apartment, ideally should cost no more than 25% of your take-home pay. Is there a similar standard for what child care should cost
there
out
is,
of your take-home pay?
Yes, it usually ranges between 7 and 10%, depending on who you talk to, but it shouldn't be more than that. And it unfortunately is significantly more than that for most families who pay.
I'm sure a lot of families who heard you say that were like, well, we are not standard.
Yeah.
We are way, way, way past standard. Speaking of families, quite a few of you shared your stories about how the cost of childcare affected your family planning decisions. Here's what Rebecca left in our inbox.
My experience with the high cost of childcare, particularly in this part of the country, is that it has been so prohibitive that my husband and I have chosen not to have children yet. We both work full-time at jobs that we love. Neither of us wants to stay home, nor can we afford to lose half of our income to stay home with a child, which leaves us with the conundrum of how do we then add on an additional cost of potentially up to $2,000 a month to be able to have a child in a daycare or a childcare center. So we have chosen to not have any children at this point in our lives simply because it's unaffordable to do so.
Yeah, Rebecca, I appreciate the story. Thanks very much. And Elaine, I kind of see both sides of this. On the one hand, you know, clearly Rebecca would like to be able to start a family. That's a very human imperative. On the other hand, I also see the other perspective from some of our listeners saying, you know, that's a prudent decision. If you know that starting a family is unaffordable because of childcare, you're doing the right thing by waiting.
So I think Rebecca points out a big conundrum for our society, as Gina said. Rebecca is talking about a two-parent, two-person family in which both work jobs that they like, even love. We're not talking about a family that we normally think of as struggling. If families like Rebecca's cannot afford to have children, we need to think what implications this has for our society and our population down the road. If Rebecca can't afford to have children, presumably people below Rebecca's income level definitely can't afford to have children. And who are going to staff all of our jobs in our society going forward? This is no longer a problem just for Rebecca.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Cheryl tweeted, "My daughter-in-law works at a daycare. She makes $7.25 an hour, which is Pennsylvania's minimum wage. The owner has four daycare places, and she is paying her workers nothing." Gina Adams, what about Cheryl's tweet? Standards for pay and compensation and treatment of child care workers. Are there any? Do we need better standards?
Well, I'm not really sure it's an issue of standards. I think it goes back to what Elaine was talking earlier about, a market failure. I mean, simply the part of the problem is that if that provider starts paying people better wages, they're going to raise their fees. If they raise their fees, then their parents may not be able to pay and they've lost their market. So the fact that we have a market-driven system in a place where the market doesn't work means that that provider and Cheryl's daughter is going to be, they're going to be in this bind for a very long time unless we figure out some way of infusing the resources into the system so it's not simply reliant on what parents can pay.
Elaine, following up on what you said about this two-parent family kind of middle class, Rasan writes, "I worked two jobs, 7 days a week for 3 years to pay daycare fee of $439 per week for our three children. Will the government help married middle class people?"
It depends on which government. But if we're talking about the proposals currently on the table, whether it's the proposals in both the House or the Senate or Elizabeth Warren's proposal, both of them recognize exactly that problem and do start to help families. And as Gina said, understand that between rent that's becoming increasingly unaffordable and childcare that's becoming increasingly unaffordable and down the road college that's becoming increasingly unaffordable, something has to give. And one of those things has to be childcare. And we have to recognize that, like rent, there should be a cap on how much families are paying.
Let me see if I can squeeze in one more quick voicemail from Mike in Long Beach, California. Here's what he left in our inbox.
"I have thought about having kids before. However, the big factor is it costs way too much nowadays. And the United States doesn't really seem, or I guess the government and the government policies don't really seem to have the best interests in mind of the working and middle class when it comes to having children. I don't think they're extremely behind compared to many other countries in the world. And we need to do so much better before I would even consider seriously having a child."
Mike, I'm glad you brought up other countries. Gina, I was just going to ask if there were one or two other countries that you would look at, or rather Elaine, if there were one or two other countries that you would look at as standards with either systems or even ideas that America should just poach, should just copy, maybe in whole cloth or in part, which countries would be on the top of your list? Which one or two?
So I think every country would be on my chart with respect to paid parental leave. That's just a necessity. A country that we definitely could look to with respect to 0-5 care that's fabulous is France. So we're not talking Scandinavia, some crazy socialism. We're talking about a real European country that we can relate to, where parents can know that once their paid parental leave is over, they can put their child in a safe, stable place from the time that they're an infant all the way through the time they go to kindergarten. They'll be ready for school. Moms and dads can go back to work and the family will function.
In the meantime, Gina, and I know we're short on time, but are there things that employers can do to make this easier on their employees in the meantime, while we're waiting for Congress to do something. Is there anything that you would suggest employers, especially maybe small companies, can do to just kind of ease this burden?
Well, there's a range of things. On one level, it's understanding these constraints that their families have. So when they think about scheduling, when they think about being responsive to parents who have these crises, and understanding that it's not the parent's choice to be leaving work suddenly because of this issue. So understanding is on kind of a most basic level. And then there's an entire range from, you know, providing supports to help people find childcare, to providing resources to help pay for childcare, to actually operating an on-site program. The latter is very expensive and I think not often necessarily what parents want, but can be useful in certain circumstances.
And Elaine, before we go, what thoughts would you have maybe for either employers or for parents who are just struggling to maintain until Congress decides to pass a new law? Before we go.
I'm with Gina. I unfortunately don't think that employers are going to be able to be the solution to this problem, but I think that employers are in a position to really recognize the scope of the problem and the impact it has on them, and I would urge them to weigh in on this. This is a critical moment. We're finally having a very long overdue conversation. Employers have a lot of skin in this game, and they should take advantage of it.
Well, we will see whether or not Congress takes Ivanka Trump's suggestion in the White House budget seriously and what shakes out in the budget project process. In the meantime, Elaine Weiss, former national coordinator for the Broader Boulder Approach to Education campaign at the Economic Policy Institute. Elaine, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And Gina Adams, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, where she directs the Low Income Working Families Project and the Kids in Context Initiative. Thank you, Gina.
Thank you so much.
Remember to send us your stories about wrestling with the decision to vaccinate your kids. It's 855-236-1A1A. Today's conversation was produced by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.